This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is February 18th, 2009. This is the third session with Ted Crabb, Emeritus Director of the Wisconsin Union. Ted, we spent the last time talking about the impact of the late 60s and early 70s on the Union. And before we move on to the next section, you were telling me off tape a story that reflects the mood in the community at that time. Yeah, and so, I'm wondering if you would be willing to share that with posterity.
with posterity. Yeah, this happened in, it would have been the spring of 1970. My wife and I live in Nakoma, and at the time, our across the street neighbor was the mayor of Madison, Bill Dyke. Bill was very conservative. He was very bitter about all of the student protests on campus, had no sympathy for them, and resented the amount of city money that was having to be used to provide police protection for the city of Madison and all the damage that the protesters were causing in the city. At any rate, the protesters at some point during that May period decided that announced that their activity for the day would be a march to the mayor's house, it was labeled the Duck the Dyke. And this was announced a couple days in advance so that the word would get around campus that everybody was to organize in the library mall, and they would march the mile or so out to the Duck Pond, which is along Nakoma Road, and then from there they would march up to the mayor's house. Well, in the neighborhood, the word, when this appeared in the newspapers, the people really got nervous. And on the night of the event, my assumption and my feeling was that this wasn't going to amount to anything, that there wouldn't be enough people who would come out on an evening to march a mile or more and then move on to Duck the Dyke. And so I wasn't particularly worried about the number of people that might turn out for this kind of a protest march. But the people in the neighborhood were just apoplectic about it. The night of the event, people had taken floor lamps from the living room and extension cords and run the extension cords out in their backyard and plugged in the lights in the backyard to be sure the backyard and the area around their homes were lit up. People with young children had made arrangement to take the children out of their homes and leave them with friends in another part of the community. One of our neighbors had a walkie-talkie and was listening in on the police band radio so they could keep track of where this march was, how it was progressing. They had baseball bats and dandelion diggers armed to protect themselves and to defend the honor of the mayor. And it was just an amazing kind of a spectacle in a way that showed me at the time the different pages that the country was on. On the one hand, the students who were protesting the whole presence of the country in Vietnam, and on the other hand, as an example of the people who were just as strongly protecting their view of what America is and what it should be. And it really was an amazing confrontation, which in fact did not happen. Very few people showed up for the march, and they never made it from the duck pond up the hill to the mayor's house, so there was never anything there. And I should have added, throughout this whole time, there were police cars constantly driving around the neighborhood, just regularly, and the neighbors would wave at them, and they would wave back, and it was just almost as though they're waiting for some major confrontation to happen. But the contrast in attitudes at the time were just really something. It was an amazing period.
Now, Ted, I'm assuming the makeup of your neighbors were mostly non-university people then.
Not necessarily.
Oh.
There were some university people. There were some doctors. There were lawyers.
Uh-huh.
It was a mixture of all kinds.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't just all non-university people at all.
Okay. Well,
it was a mix.
It's an interesting glimpse.
Yeah.
Into the social climate.
Exactly.
Of those days.
Yeah. It was just amazing, and. We've thought about that many times, and as we've reflected on that period of that example of what different pages people were on in their lives, and how you would be so frightened that you'd run, take lamps from your living room to put them out in the backyard to light the backyard, and you'd be waiting on the corner with baseball bats, and as though you could take responsibility for. You're upon yourself, that you were taking that responsibility away from the police department, even though the police department were constantly coming by in cars.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, how that kind of appeal was not of interest to the students because it was going out of their territory. And it was into foreign land, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Their territory was down on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And they were comfortable there, and they knew that they had an audience there,
mm-hmm.
and that they weren't playing to this other audience. They were playing downtown, where they knew they could create to make a statement, and they knew that the press would be there to capture that statement,
mm-hmm.
and put it on the television programs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just such an interesting contrast in approaches.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
For sharing that.
Yeah.
Ted, as we move on with the interview, we want to ask you to turn your attention to the impact of the merger of the UW system on the Wisconsin Union and you.
Well, this is a very interesting story because up until early 70s, the university had two programs in higher education. There was the University of Wisconsin system, and there was the state college system, which later became the state university system. And there was growing resentment on part of the legislature that these two systems were going to bankrupt the state in competition over which could get the most money to do this or do that, or build how many buildings, and so forth. And so there, a move began in the legislature, and it really got off the ground under, well, Governor Lucey was the governor, to merge the two systems and form a University of Wisconsin system. And that was finally approved in 72-73, I think in 1973. And it included a series of new state statutes that established this. And one provision of the statutes had to do with, for the first time, providing statutory authority on the role of students in university governance. And this was a very dramatic change from where the how students were perceived up to this point. In a sense, it was interesting because it was a follow-through from the Kaufman-Soglin lawsuit that went before Judge Doyle, which I mentioned earlier, because that suit, as you recall, said that the university can't enforce rules unless they notify students what the rules are, that it's only reasonable to expect that students know what the rules are before they can be enforced.
Mm-hmm.
And what this merger legislation provided was that students were going to be involved in governance. They were going to be involved in establishing the rules that affected students. And it also provided that that students could elect their own governing bodies to represent students. And it said that students will be involved in the allocation of the so-called segregated fee into how that money would be used for the support of student activities.
Mm-hmm.
So this was really major. And what it did, in effect, was established with ultimate authority to the regents. It established the role for the chancellor, the faculty, and the academic staff and students.
Mm-hmm.
And each one Students had the concern about students, academic staff about academic staff issues, faculty about faculty and educational issues, and all three of those groups reporting to the chancellor, who had responsibility to the university system and to the Board of Regents. And so it really established a framework for this. And for the first time, as I said, it brought students into the picture. And that changed dramatically how the interaction of students with the university in terms of groups like the union, student organizations, student activities, and so forth. As far as it relates to the union, when the union was the Memorial Union was built in the mid-20s. It opened in 1928, and when in 1927 there was a student faculty university committee appointed to establish the rules of governance for the union and to also develop strategies for the financing of the union building. This university faculty student committee was chaired by Dr. Harold Bradley, who was an eminent faculty member at the time and well respected among faculty and the university. And the committee recommended that there be a constitution for the union. Then they established a governing board known as the Union Council that would be composed of 9 students and 6 non-students. The non-students were 2 faculty members, 2 alumni members, and then 2 staff members. Mm-hmm. And the students represented representatives from the student governance body on the campus at the time, and representatives of the union, the men's union program board, and the women's self-government association. Mm-hmm. In terms of the financial questions, they recommended that there be and what was called at the time an incidental fee, of which $5 per student per semester would be collected to provide money for the operating costs of the union. And there was $1.50 per student per semester identified that would go to support women's programs on the campus, which were over in Lathrop Hall, and the Women's Self-Government Association. And that was a programmatic fee, but the $5 incidental fee was a operational fee for the day-to-day operation of this new union building. That incidental fee later became known as the segregated fee. And at the time, the union was the only incidental fee that the university collected from all students, and it continued that way for a long period of time. Later, there was a fee added. I don't remember when this was added, but there was a fee added for health service, and the health service fee and the union fee were the segregated fees on the Madison campus at the time of merger. Now, on the other UW system campuses, the situation was entirely different. Well, at Madison, the athletic department was responsible for its own funding, so they charged ticket prices because they had a constituent group that would provide the resources the athletic department needed. They had a newspaper, and they charged for the newspaper, the Daily Cardinal, and that paid for the Cardinal costs. They had a yearbook, the Wisconsin Badger, that charged for the yearbook, and that paid for the yearbook costs. Mm-hmm. At the debating, the forensic programs were done through the speech department. So that, with the exception, again, for the operation of the union and the operation of health service, the student organizations all funded themselves. Mm-hmm. On the other campuses of the UW system, they already had a student activity fee, which funded their athletic program, which funded their debate program, which funded their campus newspaper, and all of the student activities on the campuses. And so these two systems were like in two different worlds. The Madison approach was that we don't need any money for segregated fees because our student organizations are strong enough to provide their own resources to operate. Well, on the smaller, and there is a large enough student body to make this viable. While on the other campuses, which were much smaller campuses, they needed the support of a segregated fee to be able to have these same kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. And when the merger happened, as I said, one of the provisions of the merger legislation was that the students will have the responsibility for the disposition of those student fees which constitutes substantial support for campus student activities. Mm-hmm. So on these other campuses, they set up their own segregated fee advisory committee mm-hmm. to allocate those student fees. In the case of Madison, initially that didn't even exist because there was no need for it. Mm-hmm. Now at that time, again, this was in the mid-70s, we in the union were very concerned about what the role of the union was going to be under this new merged system and as it relates to its relationship to the regents mm-hmm. and the segregated fee. And so we quickly set about to try and get some validation from the university system that would recognize our historical right as recognize the constitution of the union and its relationship to report to the chancellor and to the Board of Regents in terms of organizational structure. And because we had a student majority, to fall under the provision of that regent or under the provision of that statutory requirement that students had the right to organize themselves in the manner they determine and to select the representatives to participate in institutional governance. Mm-hmm. And we took the position that because our union council had a majority of students, mm-hmm. 9 students, 6 non-students, that we were responsive to the merger legislation and that we should be recognized as one of the agencies on the campus that met the terms and conditions of the university merger legislation. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, that's what happened because we, after making this appeal to the regents and to the system administration, we received letters from the university president, from the president of the Board of Regents, and from the university legal counsel indicating that, in fact, the union was responsive to the merger legislation and recognizing union counsel as that governing body that responded to this whole issue of having a student group that was responsible for the governance for students. So that was a very real relief to the union, and it mm-hmm. it came after, from the union standpoint, this the timing was such that it was also important because it once again validated our very existence. We'd gone through that whole anti-war period, the Vietnam period, in which there was a lot of criticism of the union for its role in the support of the protest movements. And this followed just a couple years later, and the validation that, yes, in fact, there was recognition by the system and the regents that our governing structure was responsive to the merger legislation, that we were operating with a structure that was responsive to student interests. So that was very, very important to us. In terms of the segregated fee, in 1977 or 78, the student government on campus for the first time proposed that they have a $1 a semester per student segregated fee to be used to support the costs and expenses of the student government, which at that time was the Wisconsin Student Association. Mm-hmm. And that was approved. And so that was the first time that the Madison campus requested and the regents approved a segregated fee for student activities on the Madison campus. Mm-hmm. And again, just to put that in context, up to this point, all of these activities for student all of these student organizations were funded by the student organizations themselves. Mm-hmm. And when the regents approved this, it was saying, yes, there is room for the segregated fee structure within the Madison campus, and you have to set up a structure in terms of how you're going to allocate that fee. And so one of us, the Wisconsin Student Association's obligations was to set up a segregated fee structure that would receive requests from student organizations and allocate those monies to those student organizations and recommend the allocation of those monies, which were then eventually were approved by the Board of Regents. Now, at the same time, as part of that structure that was necessary, The regents also asked the system administration to develop policies in terms of how this whole segregated fee issue would be carried out on a system-wide basis. Mm-hmm. And so they set about to establish a written documentation of how that would establish how the segregated fee would be allocated. Mm-hmm. And here again, as director, I was very much involved in, along with several others of us on campus, in being instrumental in shaping that eventual document, which prescribed how segregated fees would be allocated. Mm-hmm. And the document eventually evolved, called for two kinds of fees. There was the allocable fee, mm-hmm. which would be used for student activities, and that was responsive to the merger legislation, which mm-hmm. talked about the students will be involved in the recommendations for the allocation for student activities. Mm-hmm. And then there was the non-allocable fee, which was like the unions, where the monies would go for the support of buildings and facilities. Mm-hmm. And that was just a crucial decision at the time, because it avoided the conflict each year of what the role of students was in a line item by line item review of the union operating budget, for example. Mm-hmm. It recognized that was a university responsibility, that while they would accept guidance, that they would be, that the budget would be reviewed by the local student committee, mm-hmm. but those recommendations were only recommendations to the chancellor, and the chancellor had the final authority to decide what would be recommended to the UW system and to the Board of Regents. Mm-hmm. So out of that whole policy evolved the structure, which is essentially still in use today, where you have the allocable fee that the student government review committee has primary authority on, mm-hmm. recommending to the chancellor, and the chancellor, if the chancellor objects to anything, then it's appealed to the Board of Regents, where the chancellor has to defend why that allocable fee was rejected. Mm-hmm. And you have the non-allocable fee, in which the students can question some of the recommendations in terms of building facilities, mm-hmm. and the responsibility to explain why is on the students, mm-hmm. because they're in conflict with the chancellor. As an aside, as far as the union was concerned, only one time, while I was director, only one time was there objection from the student committee on a portion of the union budget. Mm. And it's interesting how times change. That one time, we were in a, and I don't remember what the time frame on this was, but we were in, as was always the case, there was never enough money to do all that you wanted to do. And one of the reductions we had called for was to reduce the number of free telephones around the building. And we used to provide free telephones. Mm-hmm. And we had proposed in the budget that we'd reduce the number of free phones to just a couple in each building. And the student government, the segregated fee committee, objected to that and appealed the chancellor's ruling to the system administration, and eventually a compromise was reached where we added some more money for free phones and kept additional free phones available. I say this is interesting because this was the one time there'd been an issue, and I would suppose this was probably in the early to mid 80s. Today, there are no free phones. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a cell phone. And we've now removed, in Memorial Union, all of the free phone, all the telephone locations have been removed except for one or two, which are pay phones. Mm-hmm. So it's just a totally different time.
And in a relatively short time.
And in a relatively short time, right. Now, I guess, what is it, 75% of the student body has cell phones or something like that?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's something like that. Anyway, it was interesting. It was the one time when there was a disagreement between the student committee, student segregated fee committee, and the union over policy, and that was on the free phone issue. But throughout all of this, the Union's interest was to make sure that the responsibility as outlined in the Constitution for the Union Council being the governing body of the Union was protected, mm-hmm. even with the changing conditions of the merger legislation, and that the authority of the Union Council was protected, working within the constraints of the merger legislation. And fortunately, we were able to achieve that, so that the council's authority was protected. And that was just, to my mind, that was one of the most important parts of the time I was director, was to ensure that the role of the council and its independence to be the governing board of the union and reporting directly to the chancellor mm-hmm. and the office of the chancellor was just primary. And we were able to achieve that.
Ted, was there an association? I'm assuming all the other campuses in the state had unions.
Mm-hmm.
Was there an association of union directors?
All of the other campuses, well, let me back up. All of the UW system, I'm sorry, the UW colleges and later universities, college system schools, all had student centers. And they were, by design, quite different than what we had here in Madison, which was a university center mm-hmm. that served the students, faculty, staff, and alumni. Mm-hmm. And we had our own 501c3 organization, the Memorial Union Building Association, that raised money for the union. We were a membership organization mm-hmm. Where you had to be a member of the union, and that's something we could talk about at some point. We were totally different than any other system school. The state college system schools, the nine state college system schools, all had university student centers. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because by design, the terminology student center was used because they didn't want, the administrators didn't want to have those unions have the same kind of authority and freedom which the Madison Union had. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to have more administrative control over those centers, and so they kept them as student centers and not as unions. Now, Milwaukee had a setup that was similar to Madison's. Mm-hmm. Green Bay and Parkside were more closely tied to what the other university centers had. Mm-hmm. Now, in total, there were 13 campuses, mm-hmm. The four UW campuses and the nine state college campuses. And yes, going back now to your question, we did in fact get together on a twice a year basis mm-hmm. To talk about common problems. Mm-hmm. And in reality, in terms of Madison's position, we had very little in common with any of the other schools. Mm-hmm. And when I would go to those meetings, one of my primary concerns was to try and listen to what was happening on the other campuses to make sure that something wasn't happening there that might have an effect on Madison, mm-hmm. or that the pressures from the other campuses were urging some change in the system relationships that would affect Madison. Mm-hmm. But in terms of day-to-day operating experiences, in terms of programmatic mission purposes, mm-hmm. There was a dramatic difference between what the Madison Union was about and what the other campuses were, other campus centers were doing.
Did you encounter jealousy?
It was certainly there. Encounter is an interesting way to ask the question. Personally, no. But very definitely there was a jealousy, there was a resentment that mm-hmm. Madison, and it wasn't so much towards the union as it was just in general towards the University of Wisconsin-Madison, mm-hmm. that Madison was the crown jewel of the system and that mm-hmm. it was able to do things and manipulate things that other campuses couldn't do, and they could get things to happen when other campuses couldn't. And everything was always at a bigger scale. Mm-hmm. So there was resentment about the role of Madison campus, and that extended across the board. The campuses weren't large enough in those days where they could have their own purchasing department, for mm-hmm. example. So all the purchasing came through Madison. Mm-hmm. And so any complaints they had about purchasing was Madison directed. Mm-hmm. And that was only one example of the inequality of the various school operations. Mm-hmm. But so there was, and at the same time, there was a lot more control at the other campuses of the role of students, mm-hmm. and of the unions, and of the whole campus environment, of things that would happen on the campus that those from Madison would hear about, and we'd just shake our heads and, oh my God. Mm-hmm. But that was the way it was. Mm-hmm. But in terms of resentment, personally, mm-hmm. I never felt that. Mm-hmm. I felt it certainly in terms of as it relates to UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. But that was just because we were the flagship. We were the big campus. We, because of our size, we did have a strong say in how things were happening.
Ted, this is a little bit off the subject, but from your vantage point today, how do you evaluate the success or failure of the merger?
I think the way it's worked out, it probably in total has probably been was beneficial. In answering that, what's going through my mind, I remember back at the time the merger first happened, and I'm not sure that this is the case, but legend has it, the understanding at the time was that there was a coordinating committee for higher education that supposedly was coordinating all of the budget applications from the various campuses and then forwarding them to the legislature. And there was a feeling that this coordinating committee was not doing its job of making the tough decisions, and they needed to have a strong manager. Mm-hmm. And they supposedly offered the job to one person who was a vice president of UW-Madison at the time, and he accepted, but there was some resentment from others, from some of the other schools, supposedly, that he did not have a PhD, and so they didn't feel he was qualified for this position. And even though he had been offered the position, they withdrew the offer, and they went out and hired another person nationally, and that person proved to be totally ineffective, and that eventually led to merger because the coordinating committee was not able to do its job of pulling the two budgets together and cracking the whip to make sure that they made the decisions and that when the university budget would go to the legislature, there wouldn't be the issues of we versus them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if the person who was the first person had been selected, I think that, and I've always felt that, he would have been successful in making the coordinating committee work. And had he done that, had he had the chance to do that, we might never have had merger, at least till much later. And
Ted, can you share his name? Are you willing to?
Well, I think it was certainly at the time it was well known, and that was Don Percy, who later was vice president with the UW system for a while and then went off and became the president of UW Credit Union. Mm-hmm. And then also had several, he headed up the Health and Social Services Agency mm-hmm. for the state of Wisconsin at one point, and very, very, very capable. individual. And as I say, at the time, we just felt that he was someone who was strong enough as a manager that he could have made the coordinating council work. Mm-hmm. And had it worked, merger probably not would not have come about. But in hindsight, going back to your original question, I think merger probably overall has been a success. It did, for the most part, force the university to be in a position where they had to make the decisions for where the money was to be allocated among the various campuses, and that was what the legislature was up and the governor were objecting to, because they got into a seesaw that if Madison gets this, then the campuses have to have a comparable amount of money, and they didn't want to be in that position of the of a whipsaw kind of a relationship. That's a long answer to your question, but
Well, it's interesting. The merger is alive and well in the minds of many of your contemporaries that I talked to. And there's a variety of responses, so I'm interested.
I think that what happened over time was that because of the personalities involved, at the time in which merger was being implemented, there was a real sensitivity of the needs of Madison, and that Madison has always been in the role of being of having be recognized that it is different from the other campuses, and there has been resentment about that, of course, because people resent the amount of money that Madison gets versus the amount of money everybody else gets. But I think if you're going to have merger, I think it worked out pretty well.
Now, a lot of faculty, I would say a lot, say that they feel since merger the significance of UW-Madison has been downgraded and that it has lost influence and it's not as important an institution as it used to be. What do you think?
Well, that I think it's very hard to answer that question because times are constantly changing, and the. You don't have the static playing field, and it's pretty hard to compare what we might have been versus where we are, because you know the needs are different. I think Madison still is recognized from a scientific standpoint as being a premier institution. From a research standpoint, we're recognized as being a premier institution. I think we've fared generally, from a budget standpoint, we fared pretty well with the legislature and how we've come out on all of this. I can remember back in the early 60s when Fred Harrington became president, one of the things that he and his vice president, Bob Clodius, did was to take a position that Madison campus had to look to the outside as to where it hired its young faculty. And where up until that time there had been if you were a good graduate student, a good graduate scholar, you had a chance to be recommended to become an instructor and then an assistant professor and to move through the ranks. And the change that Harrington and Clodius put in was that we won't hire Wisconsin people until after they've been away and have built their reputation, and then we'll be interested in them. And that was a major, major, major change for the campus. And I think probably that had a greater influence on the Madison, development of the Madison faculty than merger did. But then again, the other part of this is that Wisconsin isn't a rich state, and we don't have the money to go out and compete with the Harvards and the Yales and the Princetons and the Californias or the Michigans. Mm-hmm. And we have done amazingly well with the resources that a state like Wisconsin has had to offer in terms of bringing scholars and bringing researchers and bringing research dollars to this campus.
Ted, let me ask you now, we've been through merger and we're well into the 70s, and based on what you said on Monday of this week, the union went through a shell shock period and a quiet leading to rebuilding in the mid to late 70s. What's happening now at the union generally? How are you feeling about the union in the late 70s and the early 80s? I know that there are lots of issues that we need to address, but generally, how are you feeling about the university, the union?
Well, let's go back, and to respond to that, I want to go back, and this was a part of, in a sense, was a part of merger, was a part of the bad economic times of the early 70s. Somewhere, if you, at an earlier time, I mentioned how we had this building program that was going to remodel Memorial Union, and mm-hmm. it was turned down by the system administration because there wasn't the certainty of how we'd pay for it through fee monies. And shortly after that, approximately 1970, the university, the regents, established a policy that at least for the time being, there would be no student fee increases. And from the standpoint of the union, budgetarily, this was just a devastating kind of a decision, because there would be no student fee increases, but at the same time, the cost of living was increasing, the wages were going up for university faculty and staff, and for all employees, and the benefit costs were going up. And we just had to keep cutting and cutting and cutting to try and produce a balanced budget. And so in 1973, the Union Council adopted a position, a recommendation to the campus and to the regents that the segregated fee, and that there be an annual amount of the segregated fee which would increase in relationship to the cost of doing business, so that if your wages went up and your cost of living went up, there would be a fee increase that would reflect those cost increases mm-hmm. on a regular basis, mm-hmm. and at the same time to help ensure that that would get heard and listened to by the regents, the Memorial Union Building Association also arranged to, first of all, invite the regents to a special meeting with the trustees mm-hmm. to meet each other and get to know each other and to renew relationships. And then they requested, and it was approved, that the building association, as chairman at the time was Lowell Frouchy, made a special appearance at the Board of Regent meeting to present some background and information about the union and its desperate financial situation. Mm-hmm. And that, coupled with this recommendation from Union Council, was eventually the recommendation for a fee increase based on the cost of doing business was approved. And so in 1974 or so, for the first time for several years, we finally got a fee increase that recognized that there were cost increases that in the union operating budget that we had no control over. And we got some additional monies to help cover those costs. And that really was a turning point for the union, and the feeling of that we began to get reinvigorated in what the union was all about and what mm-hmm. we could do. We began to expand the program. At the same time, the students were getting reactivated on the campus, and so the participation in student committees was increasing, and we began
reactivated in a traditional
sense, right. And for the first time in several years, we began to see renewed interest in being involved on campus, and the union fulfilling its mission of developing not only a variety of services for the campus, but also developing a series of programs that would appeal to the broad campus community and would justify the union's historic role as being a contributor to the whole educational process. So starting, as I say, starting in the mid-70s, we began to see a definite upswing, and that really culminated in the 70s with the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Memorial Union, which was held in 1978. And we made a big thing of that, and we...
What does that mean to...
Well, we had special programs, year-long programs. We had fundraising for the first time. Chancellor Young took the initiative back in 75 or 76 to talk to the foundation, UW Foundation, to say that the union should be one of the options for giving among alumni. And so in 1974, the class of 1924, on occasion of its 50th anniversary, raised money for a union project, which was the expansion of the provision of money to help pay for the cost of the reception room off of Great Hall. And that was, at the time, that was, I think it was close to $60,000 or $70,000. The class of 1925 raised money for the expansion of the gallery. The class of 1927 and 28 raised over $100,000 between them for the development of a lakeshore improvement program for the Hoofer sailboats. The class of 29 gave some money for the sound system in Great Hall. So we had a whole, at that time, we had a whole series of efforts toward reunioning classes geared around the fact that these were the classes that formed the union originally, who now we were saying, come back and help the union reinvigorate itself. And then, as I said, we had special programs throughout the year that from a programmatic standpoint, and we had the remodeling of the provision of this stair tower off of Great Hall, plus the remodeling of the creation of the reception room, the addition to the gallery, expansion of the Beefeater's room. All these things were happening to celebrate the 50th anniversary. And that was followed up then with in a series of other anniversaries as they came along in, I'm trying to put my numbers together here, in the early 80s, there was the celebration of the 75th founding of the union back in 1907. In 1989, there was a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the theater. And each one of these, to try and build renewed enthusiasm of the importance of the role of the union, both for students, for faculty and staff, and for the community. So, and I trace all of this back to this, starting in 1975 or so, when we began to see a resurgence of student activity and the support from Chancellor Young. I remember one time in a meeting with Chancellor Young about the sad state of the union finances. And at that time we were saying, well, should we be asking for state funds to help subsidize the union operating costs? And he said, you never want to do that, because the minute you do that, you'll be held hostage by the legislature. And that's the last thing you want to do. And you're far better off to somehow try and muddle through, and we'll see what we can do to help. And that eventually led to his suggestion, or his proposing to the foundation, that the union be added to the list of university departments and colleges that the foundation would raise money for.
Would you say that Chancellor Young, during your tenure, was the most important chancellor for the well-being of the Union?
Well, certainly what I've just described, I would say yes, very definitely. Different time, different place. Chancellor Shalala, when she was chancellor in the late 80s and early 90s, some things happened at that time where she was very supportive of the Union and played a very significant role. Mm-hmm. But coming back to that period in the mid-70s, Chancellor Young was there and played a very supportive role for the Union. And he was critical for his support.
Ted, with those alums who were helping to raise money mm-hmm. for the 50-year reunion mm-hmm. class gift, is this when you begin to develop your significant relationships with donors to the university designating their gifts to the Union?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that started, it's absolutely right, it started with the class gifts. And that was an interesting thing because the foundation took the position that donations by classes were not significant to the foundation. They were the small donors, and it was a different group each year, and they weren't interested in spending time or effort to really encourage 50-year class gifts. Hmm. They wanted the big gifts. Mm-hmm. And any 50-year class, as you may remember, any 50-year class was always made up of two kinds of gifts. They would announce at the 50th anniversary each year, oh, we raised $1 million. Mm-hmm. Well, typically, $900,000 or more was on the gifts of specific individuals to colleges or departments, either as outright gifts or estate planning gifts. Mm-hmm. And then there was $50,000 to $75,000 each year that was the class gift. Mm-hmm. And that was the group that the Union really went after. Mm-hmm. And we were able to get, as I said, we had a class of 24, 25, 20, 27, 28, 29, 32, 34, 37, 39, 40, 42, 48, mm-hmm. 50, 49 and 50, 52, 53, 54. All of those classes gave money to the Union. Mm-hmm. They were never big gifts, but $50,000, $25,000, $75,000, $100,000, those add up. And for us, this was money that we would not have otherwise had. Mm-hmm. And so for us, this was a whole new ball game. And then from that, we then eventually, our next major effort was to focus on the theater as part of the 50th anniversary of the opening of the theater back in the mid-80s when we had a campaign to raise money for the Theater Endowment Fund. When we first started talking about this, I can remember saying, well, I think our goal should be $250,000, $200,000, $250,000. And on the Memorial Union Building Association, the Union trustees said, oh, that's not enough money. You got to have it more. Oh, okay, $400,000. Well, we finally agreed on, I think it was $600,000. Mm-hmm. We ended up raising close to $1 million.
Really?
Yeah. And again, it was a combination of gifts from individuals, gifts from some classes, and gifts from some estates, and one gift, a very nice gift from the Evue Foundation. But in total, we ended up raising close to $1 million.
Ted, who are some of the significant donors to the Union that you've worked with over the years? Individuals.
Yeah. Well, one of the I have to think back through my, one of the major donors was Porter and Lou Butts, who gave money to the, made major gifts to the class of 24, which was Porter's class, and the class of 28, which was Lou's class, as they left an estate gift of $100,000. Mm-hmm. Lowell Frouchy left an estate gift of, it wasn't an estate gift, it was a gift while he was still alive of $50,000 for the Theater Endowment Fund. And back at the time in the, for all of these, back in the time in the mid-80s, those were growth years on stock monies. And so what was $50,000 in 1980 doubled and tripled over time. And so those were major gifts to have for us. Again, the kind of level of giving that we were getting wasn't particularly significant, wouldn't be particularly significant to the medical school or the business school or the engineering school. But for us, these were major, major gifts. In terms of other donors, a classmate of mine who was the chairman of the music school gave, or a music committee, gave an estate gift of $50,000 to the Theater Endowment Fund.
Who was that?
Jim Wackenfuss. We had the another classmate of mine at the time of the 50th anniversary of the class of 1954 gave a $20,000 gift to the redo of the lobby outside of the main lounge. The class of 52, which raised money for the redo of the remodeling, refurbishing of the main lounge. David Granger gave a very nice gift to that fund. We didn't receive many large gifts, but we received a lot in the $10,000, $20,000, $25,000 range. Mm-hmm. And that was really important.
Ted, over the years that I was with the UW Foundation, I would meet alums who had been, when they were students, mm-hmm. on the sure. Union Directorate. And they just demonstrated a huge, yeah. deep commitment yeah. to the union. Uh-huh. Have you worked with a lot of those alumni?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And that's our so-called union family. Uh-huh. People who are involved in the union as students on our program committees and on the council, uh-huh. and who have, in many of those cases, if you talk to them, they would say they learn more from their union experience than they did from their classroom experience in terms of what became their career areas of career development.
I think of Barbara Manley.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Is she still active?
She's still active. In fact, I had an email from her this morning. Very definitely a good example. But there's, you know, Don Ryan. I don't know if you ever met
from
Don
Janesville.
From Janesville.
Sure.
Same way. There's just a whole series of people who were very committed students to the union when they were in school and who went on to be successful. And Barbara Manley, you asked for donors. There's one who has been a very generous donor to the Theater Endowment Fund on a regular basis. Barbara and Frank. We have a large base of support among that group, and they're a group that have not been, they're not a not necessarily a particularly wealthy group. Mm-hmm. They don't have the big bucks that, they're not the Grangers or the mortgages or mm-hmm. the Nicholases or the major donors to mm-hmm. the university. But in terms of dedication to the university and to the union, they're every bit as strong a donor mm-hmm. as the ones who make big names for themselves and give some of their monies to the university. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. This is just a wonderful group of support group. And this is another item that it fits in here, but it's another item I'd like to come back to at a time and talk about, and that's the Union Terrace. The enthusiasm among alumni for the Terrace, their memories, when you say, well, what do you remember about the University of Wisconsin? Almost invariably, the Terrace will come up as their example that they'll cite. What was the most memorable spot on campus? The Terrace.
Well, why don't you run with that? I mean, because I want to get to the Terrace. Terrace is...
It's the university icon.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is the icon. And I'll comment on that, and it's one I was personally involved in. The Terrace has always been a special place on campus. And we knew for a number of years that we were limited by the size of the Terrace to how many people could be on the Terrace at any one time, and we constantly talked about wanting to expand the Terrace. And that finally, in the early 80s, became a reality. A person here in Madison died and left an estate gift to the Board of Regents designated for the Wisconsin Union. And we decided that the best use of that gift would be to use it to expand the Terrace. This was a person who was not a UW graduate. He was not a union member. He was unknown to us up to that point. He used to come down here and spend time in the Terrace, and particularly would go out on the one of the piers to fish, and would also attend travel adventure films. And that was his contact with the union.
Who was it?
A fella, I'll have to come back and tell you. I'm blanking on it right now.
Okay.
Risser was his name. And
Fred Risser?
No, not Fred, nor Bob, who was later a lifeguard at the University Life Saving Station, although he was a cousin. Bob Risser was a cousin of this individual. But here was suddenly this gift, and it was about $100,000. There was some property, there was some cash, and it was left to the regents and just designated for the union, and we proposed to the chancellor that it be used to expand the Terrace, and that was accepted, and so we began a job of planning for the expansion of the Terrace, and we worked with the landscape planning department of the Madison campus, and with the head of the landscape planning department, a fellow by the name of Dick Tipple. And we struggled long and hard to come up with a plan that would really take advantage of this particular piece of land out here and to really make it something special. Early on in the process, I happened to be watching a television program that was a program of William H. White, who you might even remember, he wrote The Organization Man back in 1957. Well, he had been hired by a private foundation to do a study of plazas in New York City. And this was after the new buildings had been built, and they had plazas, and some were successful and some weren't. And this foundation wanted to know, why does this plaza work and not another plaza? Mm-hmm. And so he set up a long study to develop some explanations of why this building plaza works and another one doesn't. And then he developed a pamphlet to describe his conclusions, and he also developed this television program. And I just, by chance, happened to be watching WHA-TV one night and saw this, and I said, oh my goodness, this is exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I wrote and got the book and got his principles, and we set about to try and apply his principles right down the line, and everyone, we had the perfect setting for every single one, and we could do it, and it was excellent. For example, people on a terrace, on a plaza, are there for a couple reasons. They want to be seen and they want to see. They want to see who's there, and they want to be seen so that they could be incorporated into the groups that are there. Mm-hmm. People want to, they want different kinds of seating spaces, mm-hmm. Tables, and also decks that they can sit on, or retaining walls that they can sit on. They want to have areas that are ripe for sitting in the spring and fall when it's cool, but offers a different alternative in the shade in the summertime, mm-hmm. so that you can also enjoy the area without being in the steaming sun. Mm-hmm. They want to have areas that are easy to walk around, so that you can walk along and see who's present. Mm-hmm. If you have steps, they want to have steps so that they be a low rise, so that you can go up and down the steps without feeling that you're changing grade. Mm-hmm. And the steps that should be wide, so that again, it's just a casual change in elevation without your being conscious of it. You want to have food service that's quick and convenient to fit in with whatever it is. Programming becomes a part of this, so that you'll have programs that will draw people to these spaces. Mm-hmm. Well, working with Dick Tipple and the Landscape Planning Office of University Construction, we developed this plan that used these basic William White principles for the Union Terrace, and they all just worked. I mean, it was wonderful the way it all came together. We went through probably 4, 5, 6 different sets of plans, but each one was an improvement on the other. We got a buy-in from the class of 1936 for some bricks over on the terrace outside of the cafeteria. That's where people could put their names in the bricks. Mm-hmm. We got support not only from the estate gift, but then support from the union operating funds to help pay for all of this. The union, the Memorial Union Building Association, put in some money, and we were able to go out for bid. The bids came in within the budget, and we were able to do this. And from day one, when it opened in 1987. The terrace was a great success. Mm-hmm. And all of those principles that White had identified were put in practice, and they worked. We had the theater steps where people could sit down and observe mm-hmm. who was there. We had the railings around the former terrace that people could sit on. And it's important in railings. He said your railings have to be at seating height so that you can sit on them and be comfortable. And that's what those railings were. We provided several different areas of seating so that people could move from in the spring and fall being down close to the lake, and in the summertime they could move up into the old terrace where it was shady with the wonderful oak trees that were there.
Ted, was there any difficulty with the city doing or the county doing work on the edge of Lake Mendota?
Well, what we because all of the effort in the terrace remodeling of the 1986 and 87 was done to the south of the sidewalk that parallels the lakefront. Uh-huh. So we didn't interfere with the lakefront at all. Okay. Now that lakefront, that's a whole nother story in terms of that particular project on the lakefront was done in 1970, and that was a state contract where they hired a national firm to develop a plan for the redo of the lakefront from Lake Street to the Park Street turnaround.
Oh.
And that project was done in, as I say, in 70, 71. And the planner just really missed the ball on it mm-hmm. because he didn't understand the kind of lake that Mendota is. And he called for this breakwater that extends, that provides a U-shaped water spot behind the armory, mm-hmm. and with the idea that that was going to be a boat docking location.
I've always wondered yeah. how that ever
and got there. And he put in, he brought in truckload after truckload of sand to create a sandy beach on the other side of that boat docking station. And we said at the time, we said, that's a horrible mistake because you have to have water flowing through that whole area to flush out the debris that comes in every storm. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't listen to us and insisted this is the way it had to be, and you'll have this wonderful sandy beach, and it'll be just terrific. Well, within a year or two, the sand had all washed out. Mm-hmm. Within a year, the university was having to come in once a month and empty out all of the debris that collected in that, mm-hmm. I'll call it cesspool, that he originally envisioned as being a boathouse. And he didn't properly provide a filtering system behind the stone wall that he put in place so that the water would wash out the dirt behind that the stones that were there to be the along the edge of the shoreline. Mm-hmm. And hence that even today you walk along the alumni house and they've got it blocked off because it's eroded, the stones have fallen down, they've already on one or two occasions have come in and had to mud jack those areas to build up the ground underneath the walkway. And it's just been a mess, and that was predictable from when it first went in. Mm-hmm. So coming back to your original question, we weren't involved along the lakeshore at all, so that was not an issue. It was an issue when we put in the lakefront improvement project from Park Street down to the Limnology building.
Oh.
And that's a whole other story. But for the terrace part of it, this wasn't an issue. This was the area. It was all on university property, and it worked out just beautifully.
Ted, part of the charm of the terrace, to my mind, is that the word used to describe it is terrace.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear that word much. Mm-hmm. Do you know how it came to be called the Union Terrace?
No, but that's how it's always been known. And from knowing the history about the development of that space, I would have to think that this probably goes back to the time it was constructed in the spring and summer of 1929. And the layout was developed by the daughter of the state architect, who was also the architect for this building. Mm. And his daughter was a graduate of one of the Eastern design schools. And she came out here and didn't have a job, and he hired her in the state architect's office, and her job was to design, to lay out the terrace. And she was the one who laid out the original terrace that was built in starting in the winter of 28-29 and finished up during 1929. And it was known as the terrace from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that probably somewhere in the literature for fundraising for the union, they probably used the name terrace, that there would be a terrace in back of the union leading down to the lake. And there's some very descriptive words about this in the original fundraising literature. And that probably, as I say, used the word terrace, and that has followed ever since. Now, when it came to the remodeling of the terrace, the expansion of the terrace in the 80s, one of the things we took advantage of was the different elevations of the terrace. They're actually the original terrace, which is up next to the building, is at a higher elevation. Then the terrace outside of the cafeteria is at a medium level going down. And then the terrace down at the lakefront is at a third level. But the advantage of that, and again, this is right out of William White, it establishes clear views for people. Looking from, if you're on the upper level, you don't have to look into the faces and the backs of people on the lower level. Mm-hmm. You can see the lake. So that was another part of the design of the terrace. A totally different aside, which just popped into my mind. It's also so very interesting. When the building was originally designed in the 20s, the architect, well, all of the language in the promotional materials for fundraising talked about its relationship to the lake. The architect had relatively little sensitivity to the lake in his design for the building. if you're in Great Hall, in order to see the lake, you have to be standing up at the windows. He put the windows so high mm-hmm. so that if you're sitting down at a table, you can't see the lake. Mm-hmm. In the cafeteria, in the original cafeteria design, the windows were all covered in a heavy drape so that you didn't see outside to the lake. Mm-hmm. And there was the serving line, and the original cafeteria serving line was on the west wall of the cafeteria, which looked out onto the terrace, and so it wasn't visible from the cafeteria. So the architect wasn't sensitive at all mm-hmm. to the lake, and it was only when in the mid-50s when the union remodeled the cafeteria and put the deck around the lake and around the building and back here to connect the second floor levels, that suddenly the lake and the terrace became an integral part of the building. Mm-hmm. So that through the first 25 years, the terrace was here and they talked about it and it was program space, but yet the terrace and the building were not integrated. That only came in the early 50s, or the middle 50s in 1956, 57. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when we expanded the terrace in 1986, then that really made that a focal point. Now, another part of the terrace that is crucial here is the Union Terrace chair. And that the symbolic piece of the sunburst back on that chair. Mm-hmm. And here again, it's an interesting story that that chair was originally made by the Troy Sunshade Company. And they went out of business in the mid-50s. And we searched around to find a replacement chair and we finally ended up contracting with a firm in Chicago to fabricate the tools and dies to make a comparable chair. And we bought a bunch of those. And then in the mid-60s, that company went bankrupt, and before we knew it, they sold all of their tools and dies at auction as part of the bankruptcy sale, and so we were back to square one again. Okay. And again, we tried to find a comparable, usable, functional chair for the terrace, and were unable to. So at that point, working with the Memorial Union Building Association, we contracted with a fabricator down in Oregon, Wisconsin, Wisco Industries, to develop a whole new set of tools and dies for that terrace chair. And we owned the tools and dies, and we would then lend it to Wisco to fabricate the actual chairs so that we could continue to have that chair. What's unique about that chair? Well, there are several things. One, it has a round bottom, and the original chair, the original terrace had flagstone on the terrace, and that round bottom was wonderful for being on flagstone because the chair could adjust to a variety of different elevations of the flagstone mm-hmm. versus being on four legs where they were never level. And so we continue to use that even though we now have a smoother surface on that terrace. It still works out extremely well because there's great stability because it's a round bottom. It spreads the weight and isn't putting all the weight on four legs. But the symbol of the sunburst is really the one that coupled with the terrace itself has really established an image in people's minds when you talk about the University of Wisconsin. Oh yeah, that's for the Union Terrace, and that's the sunburst chair. And we helped that by we developed in the 80s, again, at the time of the opening of the terrace, we developed the t-shirts and logos and red coffee mugs with the terrace symbol on, or with the chair symbol on it. And that became our trademark, really.
Ted, I remember from one of my first visits to the Union Terrace, which would have been in the late 60s, the chair bottoms were sort of springy.
Well, that's a different, that particular chair. Oh yeah, yeah. I referred to that as the garbage can chair because the top was like a garbage can. And the problem with that chair was that water would collect around the frame of the seating to which those pieces of spring metal were attached, riveted to this round frame for the seat, and water would collect in there and rust the rivets. And then the spring that you're referring to would pop out, and we used to get, every year we'd get a bunch of claims against the union for people who tore their pants on a pop spring. And that chair, many, many, many years later, was reactivated, and I brought back, and I think it was in the Martha Stewart collection, or one of the major exterior design people brought out that chair, and it still is available. We have about...
Oh, is it? I love that chair.
We have about, still have about 20 of them that are on the deck surrounding the theater that are the last remnants of those original, as I say, garbage can cover chairs. With the spring sections that supported the weight, and they were a very comfortable chair.
Oh, they were very comfortable.
But they had one basic problem, and that was they would rust out, and then they would be wonderful for tearing a pair of pants on.
Okay, well, when this is all done, I'm going to ask you for a lead as to where I can go.
Oh, well, I can provide that.
Go get some of those.
So that's the story of the terrace, and
Ted,
again,
one thing
just,
I want to ask you about the terrace.
Mm-hmm.
You said Monday when you were talking about one of the costs associated with the days of turmoil on campus, mm-hmm, was that faculty stopped coming, mm-hmm, to the union. Mm-hmm. It has certainly been my experience. I see faculty and students, mm-hmm, on the terrace.
Oh, yeah. Yep, absolutely. And again, that was one of the great changes that began to happen later as we moved away from Vietnam and started to rebuild a community on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And faculty did, in fact, move out of their classrooms, and one of the places they would come to would be the terrace,
mm-hmm,
with their students to sit around and have a glass of beer and to talk about the particular issues within their particular field.
Mm-hmm.
So that very definitely happened. It would happen in the Roskeller also, where people would come to the Stiftskeller with the same thing, where a class group would come down and meet in the Stiftskeller and get out of the classroom. And that's the kind of interaction,
mm-hmm,
that the union should be encouraging and promoting.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful when that began to happen.
I like to eat on the terrace,
mm-hmm,
in the summer, the spring and summer. You set up food down there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a relatively new development, or does that go way back?
Well, time is relative.
Uh-huh.
That brat stand came with the expansion of the terrace in 1986.
Okay.
Now, up until that point, the only food on the terrace really came from either the cafeteria or the Roskeller. You'd go through the cafeteria line and get food and carry it out to the terrace,
mm-hmm,
or you'd go through the Roskeller and carry it out to the Roskeller. In the late 70s, we took a window that was a window in the Stiftskeller and would open it up and service to the terrace directly from that Stiftskeller window behind the Stiftskeller bar,
mm-hmm,
and we would have one window that was opened
over
up.
Here.
Yeah, right. And one window that was opened up to service the terrace during warm weather, and that was done simply to to provide another beer station and to service the people and the long lines that would develop on those wonderful nights on the terrace to try to get more. Being able to respond to customers.
Mm-hmm.
But the food service you're talking about, really, that started after the opening of the expanded terrace in 1986, 87, and then we would, since then, we've added an ice cream station,
mm-hmm,
on special occasions. We've added additional beer stands on special occasions, on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
But the brat stand is the major one.
And that's operated by the union.
By the union, right. Yep. And through all of this, what the terrace suddenly provided was a real coming together of the community, mm-hmm. in which you had students and faculty and staff and alumni and community coming to one place and being together and interacting mm-hmm. with one another because of the fact that you're all here. And we added to that by having programs on most every night. The one night would be films, another night would be open mic, another night there would be jazz bands mm-hmm. or combos, and another night would be other kinds of musical groups. But there's programming going on almost every night. Mm-hmm. And again, it drew people to the terrace. In terms of the membership nature of the terrace, our best control for that was that if you purchase a beer, mm-hmm. you had to show a membership card mm-hmm. that you were a union member. Mm-hmm. Now, we realized that there would be potentially non-members on the terrace, mm-hmm. but if you wanted to purchase a beverage, you had to be a union member to purchase that beverage. Mm-hmm. And that...
Did that work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it didn't catch everybody because you'd get people who were non-members and they'd send the one member up to buy the beer for the table.
Of course.
But it worked, and the majority of the people were members. And when we had problems on the terrace, we would identify people where we would might be concerned that a group didn't look like students or didn't look like members, and we would go up and card those tables mm-hmm. just to check membership. And to see, yes, and we would say to people, you know, you can become a union member, here's the information on it, but until you are a member, you can stay for this time, but in the future you have to be a member to be here, mm-hmm. or a guest of the university, mm-hmm. so that a person coming down to visit the university, or a person that's here for a conference, those people are all eligible to be on the terrace, but it's the person in Madison who's just coming here is... And that person, we want to reach them and get them to join and take out a membership.
So if you're not a member of the union, but you're an employee of the university, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is that like being a member?
Yep. That's part of, as an employee, it entitles you to use of the union. Now, mm-hmm. if there are distinctions for an event where there's a member, non-member price, uh-huh. you would pay the non-member price, but you could attend the event.
I see.
If you wanted to join Hoofer's Sailing Club and you're an employee of the university, you can join and take memberships, but you would pay a non-member price.
Ted, it just occurs to me to ask, when John Wiley was chancellor, you know, he gave a lot of attention to student drunkenness mm-hmm. On campus and in the bars on State Street. Is drunkenness a problem on the terrace?
You know, I think that would be, I would like to have that as a separate topic
okay.
for another time.
Okay.
Because that gets into the whole issue of, during the time I was director, the drinking age in Wisconsin went from 18 for beer and 21 for hard liquor to 18 for beer and liquor, and then went up to 21 over a 3-year period for everybody. And then later we got into this whole question of alcohol abuse, mm-hmm. use and abuse, mm-hmm. And when John Wiley wasn't very definitely involved in that. And there's some kinds of things I think we could cover as a specific topic
okay.
that would tie into that
okay.
question.
Let me just conclude this. This now concludes the third session with Ted Crabb.